This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
We're very privileged to have a collection of scholars here at UC Santa Barbara who are experts on crowdfunding, and I'm really grateful that they've all agreed to share their expertise with us today. From three quite different disciplinary perspectives. First, we're going to hear from Dr. Holly Unruh, who is the Associate Director of the UC Institute for Research in the Arts. Dr. Unruh will share her research on the crowdfunding phenomenon in the academic arts. Then we're going to turn to Professor Kumkum Bhavnani of the UCSB Department of Sociology. Kumkum will share her experience of successfully raising a lot of research funds with Kickstarter, which, if you don't know, is the leading crowdfunding internet platform. And then finally, we'll be hearing from Dr. Jai Ranganathan and Dr. Jarrett Burns, both postdoctoral scholars at the UCSB National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis, otherwise known as NCES, and they are more importantly co-founders of the SciFund Challenge, which is the leading online platform for science crowdfunding. They're going to talk about the SciFund Challenge itself and then also share results of their recent research on the crucial sort of alchemy of elements that are necessary to make a science crowdfunding campaign successful. So after each of the presenters has taken her or his turn, I'm going to ask them all to come up to the front to answer questions. So please hold your questions for the end. And without further ado, help me welcome our panelists. And Holly, take it away. Thank you.
Well, hi. So I'm starting with a giant advertisement for UC Institute for Research in the Arts and our webpage here. And I just brought that up because I wanted to just sort of give a sense of where I come from in this debate. UCIRA is the only arts funder for the whole University of California system, and we have a very small amount of funding that we give out. And what we find as a funder is that there are a lot of things that our artists want to do that we're unable to match with our funding. And the same goes true for state, federal funding, other foundations. And so a lot of our artists are turning to crowdfunding to fill the kinds of needs they have to get projects done very quickly and nimbly and without having to really shape the work that they're doing to the desires of a funder. But they're able to go out, do what they want to do, the way they want to do it, and get that project funded quickly. I did a little bit of research with our artists, just sort of asking them about their experiences with crowdfunding. And I got some interesting responses that I'm going to kind of mix in today. For instance, Dan Fruit, who teaches in the World Arts and Culture program at UCLA, describes crowdfunding as, quote, a logical extension of the personal appeal letter that many artists send out in November or December of most years. I think for a lot of artists, it's kind of uncomfortable to think about putting your stuff up on Kickstarter or Indiegogo or one of these platforms, but you shouldn't. It really is just sort of a different way to think about the way that you've already been going out and raising money from individuals. And a lot of the artists I talked to asked this question, is it really worthwhile to go out and look for money from individuals when I can be funded at the university or through the traditional methods of grant writing, et cetera? And it really is, and I want to give you some statistics why. According to the most recent statistics from the NEA, private individuals donate $8 billion annually to the arts, foundations $4.1 billion, and people spend an additional $32 billion on the arts in this country. And there's a way in which we can look at some of the crowdfunding platforms really as a way that people are spending money on the arts, too, because people do consume products in that way. And it's important for you to think about what you're doing also as a product that someone's going to want to buy and connect with you as an artist through. The benefits, as I mentioned, include a quick turnaround. Generally, it's 30 to 45 days to get your money. It's a lot different from most funding cycles that we see out there. And it's really important for you to understand crowdfunding because, I think theoretically in academia, you could say, well, I can go through my whole career without ever having to apply for an extramural grant or go to a foundation. But the funding climate's changing. A lot of the kind of work that people want to do doesn't really sort of click with what's being funded within the academy or even what our state and national funders are able to fund at the moment. So it really is important that you start to look at this different model. And I'll give you one last example why. Last week, Kickstarter co-founder Yancey Strickler announced that his three-year-old crowdfunding platform expects to raise $150 million for creative projects in this year alone. This year, the NEA's entire budget for the entire country was $146 million. It's kind of like comparing apples and oranges. The NEA funds very different kinds of things. They fund big institutions. They fund access, equity, outreach kinds of programs, not individual artists. But when you compare the dollar amounts, I think it tells you a lot about the potential for what can be raised online. The same can be said for the state of California, for instance. We are 49th in the nation in terms of per capita arts funding, so turning to the state for your money is not a good option either. So what I'm showing you here is actually a project that's done by a pair of UC Berkeley graduate students who we have funded through UCIRA for a sort of planning grant for an entirely different project. But they went to Kickstarter to raise money to do a residency at Elsewhere, which you can see a little bit about it down here at the bottom, because it's not something that we could fund. And it really wasn't something that they could fund through their department, through their campus. And they were very quickly, as you can see up there, able to raise a lot more than they had planned to get themselves to North Carolina to do this residency. A sample of kind of things that artists are crowdfunding at the moment: unrestricted funds to make your work, and I can't emphasize that enough. It's very rare that you get to go out and simply say, this is what I want to do, how I want to do it. Travel and residency, like you see right here. Research and presentation funds. For the performing arts, that's kind of a usual thing to ask for, right? You know, funds to take your show on the road, in essence. But this even happens for visual artists through crowdfunding. If you pitch your project the right way, you can actually get yourself out there, travel, present your work in different ways. And those funds are really hard to come by on your campus if you think about where you might go, except for the IHC, to ask for some money to travel, or Academic Senate, maybe. One example, Patricia Watts, who is runs a nonprofit called Echo Art Space, raised almost the entire amount that she needed to go to ISEA in Istanbul through an Indiegogo campaign. $5 a piece from everyone she knew, and she was able to fund her trip. You can get finishing funds for your films, books, art publishing, gallery shows, publishing subventions, and even conferences and research gatherings if they're pitched the right way. So I wanted to start with a little bit of information about this particular campaign by an artist, Steve Lambert, whom some of you might know. He's worked with the Yes Men, for instance, on a fake New York Times edition that made a lot of headlines a few years ago. He's also a UC Davis graduate. And I wanted to start it because not only did he raise a lot of money this way, he asked for $9,000, I think, to begin with, and ended up raising over $17,000. But the project itself actually talks a little bit about some of the issues that come up when we think about crowdfunding. The work is essentially a mobile polling station, and it makes appearances now in cities throughout the United States. It's very simple. It's based on the sort of classic American baseball scorekeeping card. And he asked people the very simple question: capitalism works for me, true or false? People push a button. You have 30 seconds afterwards to wait, discuss, hopefully with the people around you, not vote a second time. But the work itself is really playing with this idea, too. Does this kind of capitalist system, a new way of looking to not the government for public support for the arts, but, you know, other people outside of state support, does it really work? And it's very interesting as you follow this project around the country to see the different kinds of responses in different communities throughout the country. But he was somebody that I interviewed, to sort of think about this question, because he's on Facebook. It's one of the ways that he's been very successful in terms of pitching this project to us. He's all over Facebook and Twitter and blogs and this kind of thing. But he posted this kind of controversial observation on Facebook, and he said that crowdfunding essentially equates to artist support for right-wing tax cuts. And so I asked him, can you expand on that a little bit? His very long answer you can read on our UCIRA blog, that's right down here on the bottom. But this is the short version of what he said. In George H.W. Bush's 1989 presidential campaign, he began using the phrase, the thousand points of light. The idea being, when we cut government spending, everything will be just fine because all of these wonderful community organizations and charitable people, the thousand points of light, will sweep in. Government programs aren't needed because volunteers will do the work. This brings me to my fear. How is what the right wing dreamed of years ago different than what we celebrate as crowdfunding today? The NEA hasn't funded individual artists since the early 1990s, and state art budgets are getting cut in record numbers to record lows. Kansas recently cut its arts funding entirely. On the other hand, Kickstarter, and this is about a year ago, has moved $60 million for over 10,000 projects since it launched. As someone who's personally created various crowdfunding strategies and campaigns, I know from experience the support comes primarily from our own networks. While we individually route our money, perhaps losing some to Amazon along the way, to help support each other, public funding could use $1 per taxpayer to each year quintuple the amount Kickstarter has distributed since it began. Even more if we tax corporations at the rate we did a few decades ago. Don't we all agree this form of crowdsourcing is less of a burden on our already strained communities and a better use of our state funds? We're artists. We're independent, creative, and resourceful. When we see a problem, we find ways to solve it. But instead of using our skills to engage power and secure public funding of the arts for now and the future, we've accepted the right-wing paradigm and started working within it. And we've done a great job. Crowdfunding is remarkable in solving short-term problems. Artists need to get paid. Our culture needs and clearly wants these projects to exist. We want to participate in the community, but how are we solving our long-term problems? There are many lenses through which to view crowdfunding, as a streamlined and democratic update to private philanthropy and foundations, pre-sales of market goods, i.e. a DVD of my band, a limited edition print of my photography that allows the creator to gauge the market before beginning a project, or an innovation that better connects audiences to the processes through a project's life. So he has a lot to say about this, but I just wanted to bring it up because I think the artists are thinking a lot, too, about if I participate in this, what does it actually mean? And so standing up here sort of on my bandwagon, we should also be continually sort of advocating for other kinds of support for the arts, not just sort of migrating entirely to this different kind of platform. So I want to give just a super quick run through of a couple of the different platforms, and you see some of their logos up here. We're going to hear the most about Kickstarter and Indiegogo, I think, but there are some very real differences between some of them. Kickstarter basically builds itself as a platform for creative projects. And I want to just give you a couple of the things that you have to know about Kickstarter. One, you have to set a financial goal that you want to reach, and this is true for almost any one of these platforms. You have to offer rewards, whether they're tangible or not, but what their research has found is that just offering a big hug and a handshake is not going to get you a lot of supporters. You really should be offering things that people want to essentially buy from you. It's their way to connect with the artist. It's an all-or-nothing site. You have to raise your goal, or the funds pledged aren't collected or turned over to you, and you have up to 60 days, although they recommend 30 to fund your project. Kickstarter does receive 5% of the overall proceeds, and then another 3-5% goes to Amazon in fees. So these are things you need to think about when you're setting your budget for your project as well. And finally, funds pledged to the project are not tax deductible to the donor, although I know there have been some discussions on the NORDIP email list about how you might run your Kickstarter campaign through your Office of Research and actually allow some of those to be tax deductible. So you can ask Barbara or Meredith some of those questions if you have them. Rocket Hub is another one that also claims it's for creative projects, but it lists those who can participate as artists, scientists, entrepreneurs, teachers, philanthropists. So the kinds of projects you can actually run there are a little bit more varied. It has a slightly different economic model in that if you can choose to either have a goal and meet that goal and give your 4% to Rocket Hub, or you can choose to have basically a safety net and keep any of the money you raise for 9% delivered back to the platform. So if you're not really sure about whether you can meet that goal or not, it might be a place that you want to look if you're running a first project. Again, donations are not tax deductible. Indiegogo is another kind, another platform that takes basically any kind of fundraising campaign from all over the world, including research and commercial endeavors and even causes. They offer campaigns anywhere from 1 to 120 days. So if you're thinking differently about how you might want to run it or what sort of community you might want to pitch this to, it's another place to look. I want to give you two examples of places that platforms that are actually offer you the ability to take tax-deductible donations. And it might be a big deal for artists who already work sometimes with donors who want to give to their project, but they do that because they can, you know, deduct the donation. One is ArtSpire. And it is the crowdfunding platform of the New York Foundation for the Arts. You do not need to be a New York resident or artist to use them. They essentially work as a fiscal sponsor for individuals who don't have their own 501c3 designation, or for small organizations that have not yet done that. And they allow you to run your project for up to 3 years on their website. And so it's a way to more slowly sort of gather a support base and continuing donations for the kind of work that you do. So it's definitely something to look into. You do have to apply. You have to have a minimum budget of $15,000 for your project. And there's an 8% administrative fee. And then I want to skip down to USA Artists that you see up here, USA Projects. This is another one of the groups that I interviewed a while ago, and they also developed their own platform, USA Projects. You have to have a relationship with one of their partner organizations to be included, but they have over 100 different arts and creativity funders that sort of pre-vet artists. So chances are, if you've gotten any kind of outside funding for your work, you're going to be a good fit for them. They actually came up as an organization specifically at the time when the National Endowment for the Arts was cutting their individual artist fellowships, and they have a real commitment throughout all of their programs to supporting individual artist work. Unlike the other sites that we've looked at so far, which have an average fund rate of about 45 to 50%, USA Artists actually fund closer to 75 to 80% of their projects, specifically because they leverage matching funds from other big funding organizations that they work with. So if your project has something in alignment with one of their giving goals, they match those funds into your project in order to help you raise your fundraising goal. They also have a shared fundraising model that gives 81 cents out of every dollar to the artists, with the rest going to support training and education programs, fees, and grants to other artists. So they're really thinking kind of systemically about how they might support the arts. So I wanted to, you know, sort of give them a little bit of extra time. Some other ones that you could look at, but in the interest of time, I won't go over. Unbound is an online sort of publishing and crowdfunding resource for books. They've funded 15 books to date. They have another 15 that are funding. It's an interesting thing to look at if you're looking at publishing a book. For little amounts of money that might be related to more sort of social good projects, you can also look to Philanthropor and Causes that are up on the top right. Causes you can run through Facebook or other platforms like this. A friend of mine, for instance, for her birthday, invited us all to donate a little bit of money to another friend's dance nonprofit, and she raised $300 in a couple of days for her. So it's good for small amounts. Philanthropor is a daily deal site where you can have your nonprofit sort of featured. Oh, man, I'm getting the 2 minutes. Okay, I'm going to quick. Some of these platforms have curated areas. If you have a relationship with one of the curators, Fractured Atlas on Rocket Hub, Creative Time has one, the Sundance Foundation, etc. This is also a way to draw people to your work by affiliating with one of the curators. I want to play a very quick example of a really good video, because one of the most important things when you're putting this kind of pitch together is to have a video that tells you very quickly what the project is about, why you should fund it, and what they're going to do with the money. Let's see if we can get this up. Do we have audio on this? I think I'll sort of talk over this since I'm running out of time. But one thing I want to mention that is generally small, timely, object-based projects tend to see a lot of success in the arts. Here you have people that are dealing with this question of sort of the demise of not only the postal system, but these other kind of sort of public good systems, and they're doing an art exhibition with 8 artists about this. Other things that I have seen that are really successful are, for instance, online publishing platforms. There's one called N that was funded on Kickstarter that deals specifically with the question of the demise of long-form journalism and really sort of hits a question that people care about at that moment. So if you have a couple of projects you're interested in, think about that thing that's going to catch something that's in the public dialogue in one way or another, or that is going somewhere that people care about. It's sort of a bad example for an academic audience, but projects that go to Burning Man are funded very oftentimes. Edinburgh Fringe Festival is another. But you have to think of, you know, that you're reaching a very wide sort of non-academic audience, too. So that was an example of a really excellent, very short film. And I think you'll hear this from other people, too. Okay, give me 1 minute. One of the most important things to do is in that initial couple minutes where you get people online, you need a film that's going to grab people. And so use the resources that you have at the university to help you with that. Another resource area that you have are your students. If you look at the academic projects that are funded, they tend to be things that undergraduates are participating in because they have these really well-developed social networks. Use your undergraduates to help you with this. I have a couple more things that I can talk with people about later, so I'll run through the slides very quickly. I can show you what people's backer histories look like, but traditionally people fund at the $25 and the $50 level for most projects. You can see this in my friend's example here. She funds a couple of friends' projects. Generally, she funds at those usual levels, and she does it because she likes the rewards that she gets back. She wants to fill her home with art. Marketing, very, very, very important. I'll show this to you later, but basically you need to do everything that you can to identify with people to whom, by word of mouth, you're going to get your project out there. It's not just your friends and family, but you need to very carefully, before you even begin your campaign, look at these kind of things and sort of cultivate a much larger circle than you probably would have had. And then we can also, just for fun, you should take a look at this. Portlandia did a little spoof on Kickstarter. This is sort of the what not to do video, but take a look because there are some definite mistakes that you can make when you're starting your campaign.
I'm Kumkum Bhavnani. I'm in the Department of Sociology, and I raised $16,000 from Kickstarter with 101 backers. The last one that Holly showed us had 222 backers. They raised about $4,500. Mine, I understood it to be a how-to, so I'm gonna just go for it as a how-to, and then please ask me more questions. This is a research project for the University of California, but I made a documentary. I heard about Kickstarter because I was in London. There was a workshop that the workshop was about how to raise funds, and they talked about crowdfunding, and I just read, you know, I went to the workshop and I just thought, I'm never going to do this, because there, when you're making independent films, people, they stressed asking friends and family, and I just thought, how do you, you know, you can't ask people for money. This is not my thing, you know. I can only write grants. It's hard. I can't do personal development either, as some of you are probably much better at me than doing. However, I came back to the U.S. I was making a film about chocolate called Nothing. It was called Nothing Like Chocolate, and I needed money. The university has been very good to me, but as you know, in the social sciences, the university grants are, you know, $2,000, $5,000, and you feel very happy. You know, you do a little dance when you get $5,000. So, and of course, the people in engineering just look at you, you know. So what does one do for Kickstarter? It is a curated website. So they decide if they will take the project. I think they pretty much take everything, but they need to make sure that there's nothing inappropriate there. You have to have a video. And here I'm going to show my video. How do I make this bit? I do want to fill the whole screen. Yeah, just for the video. And we'll get audio. The audio starts straight away. So, okay, great.
From the moment people harvest the pods,
so let me start again.
It reaches our lips. I'm Kumkum Bhavnani. There really is nothing like chocolate. From the moment people harvest the pods to the moment it reaches our lips, it has already passed through countless hands.
I knew I had to make this film after I read that enslaved children are used to harvest cocoa in West Africa. I also knew that there had to be people who were doing things differently. My journey for answers took me halfway around the world to find the visionaries who make chocolate both delicious and ethical. On that journey, I met Mott in Grenada, an anarchist chocolate maker. There, at the Granada Chocolate Company, chocolate is made cooperatively, ethically, and organically using appropriate technologies. Here's a taste of Nothing Like Chocolate. I'm going to run through the...
Now, you're supposed to ask me what I like most about my job making chocolate. And then I say, I didn't know much about chocolate at the time, but I was told Grenada had one of the best cocos in the world. And, you know, it just seemed so obvious to me what this place needs is a chocolate factory, you know. No one else is making chocolate in a place that's incredibly difficult and expensive to make it in with a cooperative, a cocoa farmer in the world. Shortly after I dropped out of school, I just grabbed a backpack one day and a little tiny knapsack and just started to check out the islands. I got famous for my bamboo pipeline. I did that for years. I was kind of my thing, living in the bamboo house, doing my appropriate technology. And then I had this dream of the appropriate technology chocolate factory, because along the way I had fallen in love with cocoa trees that I lived amongst.
All right, so now I have no idea what to do, but all right. Okay, so making the video was really hard. I like to be behind the camera. So you saw the opening clip. Apparently, people really want to get to know you when they fund a Kickstarter project. I am so wooden in front of the camera that it was unbelievable. I don't know how many takes we did, and that was about the only bit where I didn't, where I looked as if I was not a mannequin. So making the video is critical. Setting the page up is critical. Now let me tell you a little bit about the rewards. I can't seem to find the cursor. Oh yes, I can. So you have to think about these rewards, and as Holly said, they have to be tangible. So 200 words or so for describing the project, and you can go to it if you go on Kickstarter, Nothing Like Chocolate. You can connect from the website, nothinglikechocolate.com. The film is finished, by the way. It premiered in February, just now, this last month. It's, by the way, it's been nominated for Best Doc at the Milan Film Festival, so I'm very happy. So everyone who supported it did a good job. Now look at these rewards. The rewards have to be both sort of, you know, they start off being sort of a bit serious, and then, you know, so you can have a download of this interview and that interview and so on and so forth. And then look at $100. You won't find a golden ticket, but you will find da 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 da. Yes? You have to make the rewards themselves engaging. $250 was, you know, tea with the lovely director. I have to confess, the people I know who gave $250 have tea with me anyway, so they didn't take me up on it. But, you know, so you have to think in a, you know, in something that's sort of slightly more light. Obviously, this film is about chocolate. It's, you have to think about what your minimum reward is and your maximum. And I perhaps made a mistake in both areas. I did minimum $10. And thinking about the people I was going to, maybe I should have done 20. Yes? Who funds these projects? People who don't know you, in my experience, very limited, one project. People who don't know you go at the $20 or the $10 or $50 level. And it was a pity that, you know, it doesn't matter. It's only $100 or a couple of $100. But you should think about your minimum that you're asking. The maximum, I had 1,000 and then I had 5,000 and I got someone to give me 5,000, someone I didn't know. Yes. But I wished I had done, instead of 1,000, I wished I'd done 1,500 or perhaps 2,000, because the people who I know who gave me that money, they would have done whatever that level was. They didn't want to go to 5,000. So think about the maximum and the minimum you ask for. Is this making sense? Just stop me if it doesn't. Okay. you have a whole load of questions that I just took off someone else's site. Someone had told me about this film, I Am I, that raised, it's a feature film, so it raised 100,000 or something through Kickstarter. And you could just copy those questions and answers. No one cares, right? Because it's really so that the people you go to can have their questions answered. It was a 30-day project. Honestly, it is such a lot of work. It is such a lot of work. It's worth it, but it is a lot of work. So 60 days, you get tired, and you get tired after 60 days. I'm sorry, that's my phone. You get tired after 60 days, and actually, people get tired of receiving emails. So what do you do? All right, you've got your page, you've got your blurb, you've got your projects, which take forever. I also offered a bag, you know, I don't know that I would do that again, because then I had to go around and get it designed and get it made, and, you know, so it just took more work. It was worth it, because people enjoyed it. 30-day project, you start off on the day you launch. It's critical, I was told, to have people who will give good amounts of money on the first day. So you launch it. I had a goal of 10,000, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but you need about 1,000 to come in on that first day, okay? So you need to prime people, all right? Then you are sending out emails. I was very fortunate because I could pay students neither of whom are here, wonder why, students who would send out the emails. We made a list. I had a list of about 1,000 people. And talking to a couple of others who've had Kickstarter funding, it's roughly 10%. You know, now that's not as, I haven't done a study, and it would be interesting to see of your email lists how many fund. So, but for the people I know, give or take, you know, you have a list of 4,000, you get 400 people. You send out your emails really regularly. You have to keep people in touch, and you can't keep sending the same email because then you're only asking for money. What you have to do is you have to have updates. So you send out emails on day one. You send out emails on day seven. You send out emails on then on maybe on day 12 with an update. Then maybe you wait a week again, day 19. Then you, because it's a 30-day project, then you're amping it up, right? So you go to day 24. Let's say, I can't remember exactly, and you do it every 2 days, and then the last 2 days you're doing it every day, and the emails are all, please help, we're getting to the target, you know. And I mean, I had got to the target just before the end of the campaign, so I wanted more. So I tried to persuade people to make it up to 20,000. I wasn't successful. So what you want for your goal, as Holly has explained, is critical. You don't want to ask for too much if you're on Kickstarter because you don't get it. A handy hint that I was told at the workshop about Kickstarter is, let's say, you know, I'd wanted $10,000 and I got about $9,000. You know, so I was quite a bit off, but I'd raised a substantial amount. Perhaps, you know, someone can help you fill that gap that can then be sorted out later, if you see what I mean. You prime people. The advantage of Kickstarter for me was my friends and family love the updates. I never tell them what I'm doing, you know, far too busy to do that. So they felt in touch with me. This is friends and family, and then much wider because they send it to their lists. And then people say, oh, Kumkum, I used to know you, you know, 40 years ago. And that's the sort of thing. Okay, 30 years ago. That's the sort of thing I got as well. But I got money. I mean, I would never ask my sister, for example. We're very close, but why would I ask her for $500 for a project? You know, I mean, you just wouldn't do it. The first day, she hadn't been primed. So I was getting money from people who really want to help me, really interested in my projects, but also don't know how to. So my initial reticence at asking for money, which I really dislike, all of us hate doing, allowed, it's a cliche, but there are people who do want to help you, but don't know how to. You know, they don't want to say, can I give you $100? Yeah? I mean, whoa. And if they give it through the university, that's another thing. So it was a 30-day project, emails, and we can talk a bit more about it. UCSB, I rang Eric Sundquist to see what the rules were about me asking for money, Santa Barbara Foundation, and he said as long as I didn't say UCSB anywhere on the website, I could do it. So I couldn't say it was UCSB, but and I didn't particularly need to. You know, I just said I'm a university professor by day and a filmmaker by night or something. But then I said, how do I make a tax-deductible contribution? Because people can make a tax-deductible if they go through the uni. And so I asked them to email me. And then I would tell them, oh, you make a check out to the Regents and you send it here and so on. And I got a few people doing that as well who didn't want the rewards. Thank you. And, you know, so I've got sort of no time left. I had a Facebook page. Let me just go through the points. London workshop, video, rewards. For Kickstarter, you have to have a US bank account to accept the money. And I learned about the workshop in London, but Indiegogo, it can be anywhere. So that's just a little hint, but I suppose it may not be relevant. Emails, 30-day project. You have to keep in touch with people. And that is what I did. If you look at these updates, I really don't want you to read them here because they are so embarrassing. Really, they are. Okay, let's just find some of my earlier ones. Okay, can you believe we're almost at 100%? Can you believe it? I'm so grateful. So it's yourself, right? And none of us like to see our personality up on a screen like this. But basically, my updates were about me. But I didn't have to say personal stuff. I'm not good at doing that. But I could convey what I was feeling about the project through the updates. And again, you can have it for your backers. There's all sorts of variations, and I'm happy to talk to you. So that's a quick overall view for you all on Kickstarter. Making that video is the worst bit, I think, is one of the hardest bit. And of course, you have your website up on there. Barbara had told me that she had expected academics to go on for a bit longer than the allocated time, hence talking happily way beyond it. So that's, come and talk to me, you can find me easily.
Okay. Well, I'm Jai Ranganathan, and I'm giving this presentation with Jarrett Burns, who's sitting right there waiting in the wings, and we have something really exciting to tell you about, which is, well, at first glance, it's about crowdfunding for science, but what we're really about is changing the world, and that's really what this is about. So we have, because we talk, and everything that the previous two presenters have talked about are exactly, work perfectly for ours as well. So in fact, don't have to go over a lot of stuff because it all fits in perfectly. But you can say in science, but it's true with the rest of academia as well, but just to focus directly on science, we've got two big problems. Problem one is that there's just not enough money for research. It's getting increasingly hard to get the cash year after year, harder and harder. That's the first problem. The second problem is we live in a society and in a world where people are increasingly disconnected from science. You can look at the debate about climate change, debate about evolution, and I mean, it's just disastrous. Disastrous consequences for the world that there's such a detachment from science and society. Okay, two problems. But what if these two problems had one solution? And that's the SciFund challenge. Can we sort of solve these problems of connecting science to society and connecting money to research using crowdfunding? So that's what Jarrett and I thought about. Like, maybe we can try this last summer, not knowing anything about any part of this. And it's an experiment. Can scientists use crowdfunding to communicate their science and to raise money for their research? Notice the order here. The order is to communicate their science, and that's first. The money is second. And in fact, what SciFund Challenge is it's a crash course in modern communications packaged as a money-making venture. But the money-making, at least as far as I'm concerned, is really secondary. It's really about how do you connect to audiences? That's something that scientists don't know how to do. And in fact, the culture of academia often makes you stray away from, for most anyway. Okay. As I said, the point is not cash, but engagement. So what is the SciFund Challenge? So we ran the first round last winter. We're running a second round now. And we put out a call over blogs, over Twitter, over Facebook, saying, hey, we're doing this thing. Be part of this group project. We're all going to crowdfund for science together. And we ultimately had 49 scientists jumping on board from all over the world, mostly ecologists, but we got a bunch of other things as well. And it's not surprising we got mostly ecologists because me and Jarrett are ecologists. So that's our social networks that ran from November 1st to December 15th, and the amounts that people were asking for ranged a lot, but you know, the median was about $3,500, and we partnered with Rocket Hub to actually run the projects. And I should mention one thing about Rocket, there was a bit of, to sort of piggyback on a point made earlier, there are differences in sites. The way Rocket Hub works is that if you make your target, make or exceed your target, Rocket Hub takes 8% in total. If you don't make your target, you still get the cash, but Rocket Hub takes 12% in total. That's including the credit card fees. So how did we do this? Well, we had a combination of things as sort of this crash course in communications. And we really, there's another thing is we wanted to make everything out in the open. Both Jarrett and I believe very strongly in open science and open access. Everything we know, we want the world to know. So we had a blog where everything, there was all these daily updates about how what we know about crowdfunding, what people should know, how you run these campaigns. That went up here. That was the first part of what we had. We were sort of training people. The second part is that we had a wiki, the SciFund Challenge wiki, where people posted draft projects for feedback from other SciFunders. And it was unbelievable, the improvements that's made, because as was mentioned earlier, you know, doing all these things, like putting together a video, like a short 3-minute video, like this is not like normal science training. No, nobody knew how to do it. Like using iMovie, I mean, at least Kumkum, she's like an actual documentary filmmaker, you know? You know, for us, it's like iMovie. How do you use that, you know? So this was an unbelievable resource for people to help each other with their projects. And it really is, if you can imagine the difference between the first draft to the last draft of a paper, this was that process. And other things that we used was Twitter. We have SciFund as our hashtag. For 2011, we got so much traffic through Twitter, we were one of the top 10 science hashtags on Twitter. We had a Facebook page. We had a SciFund Google group where people were emailing back and forth with each other. Really, the point was, I think what made us a little different is that we really focused on community. In the sense, it's not just each person doing the project. It's that we're all doing this together. We all succeed together. Because the point isn't the cash. The point really is to connect your science to society. And that's really something where, you know, where if you win, we all win. And along the way, we were collecting tons of data, tons of data. This is an online experiment to see what actually works for crowdfunding for science. What actually succeeds here? And tons of data. We ran a survey. We pushed a really extensive survey out to people at the end of the project. And plus, we had tons of data from Rocket Hub, tons and tons of data. And here's what it looked like. We had 49 projects, and this is the first page of projects on Rocket Hub, where we ran our projects, and there's many more pages behind that. And here's our star of the show, one of our projects, Christina Kilgrove's Ancient Roman DNA. She raised 10 grand, but this is kind of what the page looked like. We saw from Kumkum before what a page looks like on a crowdfunding site where the video is foremost. And this is what we got at the end of a month and a half. We got a little over $76,000 from 1,200 donors. And the exciting part is we're running round two now, and in under a week, we're over $45,000. So we're taking our learning and really putting it to use. And so by the numbers, so, you know, we were covered all over the place. CNN, Scientific American, New Scientist, just tons of people were interested in what we were doing. $76,000, $1,200 donors. We had 10 projects fully funded. And I think this is where, for us, where Rocket Hub actually worked well, is that, you know, let's assume for many people they hit 70% of the goal, 60% of the goal. And if that was on Kickstarter, you're a failure. You get zero. But at least on Rocket Hub, well, you still got it. Rocket Hub took a bit of an extra bite, but you still got something. I think that actually helped the community spirit. Our average project yield is $1,500, and the max was $10,000. So still small amounts. And maybe I'll stop here and let Jared take over. But let me back up to say one point, which is just to say that the point of, sorry, is just to say the one key idea here is engagement comes first. I mean, I think there's a lot of stories in the news and Kickstarter, like, this X project raised $1 million overnight. This band raised $500,000 in 2 days. You know, how did they do it? It's money from the trees. And it is not like that at all. You know, and the really amazing part about this, what I found really amazing is that this really follows, think of the NPR model. I think that's the best way to visualize it. I listen to a lot of NPR. So most of the year, they're just pushing out great programming, and they just want you to listen to it. And only after they've done that for a long time do they then come back and say, hey, how about some bucks to keep this going? Oh, and by the way, whether or not you give the money, we still want to push out with our great programming. And if you give something, if you give us money, we're giving you a tote bag. But whether or not you get the tote bag, please keep listening into what the heck we're doing. That's the model that works for here. It's not $500,000 coming from the trees. It's a really fundamental reawakening of thinking of how you think about engagement. It's not like every year or two, hey, more bucks, please. Doesn't work like that. It's really fundamentally reaching out to build a fan base for you and your research. And to me, that's tremendously exciting. On to Jared.
So thanks for the intro, Jai. So we're scientists. We like data. So as Jai mentioned, we conducted a survey, actually with Barbara's help, of all of our participants from SciFund Round 1. We also collected a lot of data from Rocket Hub. So I think Jai just made a really compelling argument for why engagement is important and why engagement, even beyond just what you're doing here, why engagement with community and with the world around you is what's going to ultimately lead into successful crowdfunding. So great argument, but because we're scientists, we were like, oh, this is great. Let's test this. Let's actually look at what our participants did and see if engagement actually did translate to successful crowdfunding. So first, just to start you off, this is what the distribution of amounts raised and total dollars, or basically the donation amounts are. So first you see that we raised around, as Jai said, around $1,500, $1,600. Smaller amounts. And I would argue smaller amounts, as you'll see, because a lot of the scientists who were participating in this were fairly new to doing outreach sorts of activities. So small amounts predominated. But the really interesting thing is that a lot of the donations, in fact, the lion's share of the donations, were small. So many small donations ended up funding these projects. So you may ask, well, okay, some of the projects that got really high levels of funding, they must have also had very high donors. They must have had just a couple of donors that really funded them. And really what we found is that this was a numbers game. To really hammer home that engagement was important, the more funders you had, the more money you were able to raise. It was about bringing in numbers of people. Sure, large donations helped, and you'll see there's some scatter around this best fit line relating number of contributions to total dollars raised. But the more people you had, the more money you were able to raise. The more engagement and the more people you could actually bring to your work who are interested in it, the more you were able to raise. So it's an engagement game. It's about bringing in engagement. And to take that one level further, I sat down with the data and with Jai and a few others, and we did a bunch of crazy statistical analyses, but we can sum them up in this kind of really nice flow going from engagement to funding. So the secret to SciFund really was engagement, and the data shows it. So if you look at participants, there's one activity that a number of them that all did, and that is blogs. So our participants, a number of our participants were already doing active outreach by blogging, engaging in science blogs, and this was really the only way we had to measure their capacity for outreach before SciFund started. And we found that an online presence basically one blog post per month translated to a larger network. And we measured a sort of network or a fan base by number of Twitter followers. So again, using some of this online tech. For every Twitter follower, for every one fan of your scientific work, you tended to get one person going to actually view your project. And for every 110 project views, that translated to one contributor. So it's about building an audience, building a fan base, and a larger fan base will lead to more eyeballs on your project. Now, it's not just this sort of fan base that you've generated as a scientist. Of course, friends and family were also important, and we measure that by Facebook network size. Unlike a number of disciplines, I know, particularly in the arts, that Facebook is also a very professionalized space. My wife is actually a playwright, and it's like that's where work happens in some ways, through those personal connections. In science, it's different. In science, Twitter is really our professional online network space, and Facebook has, for whatever reason, remained cordoned off in its own separate personal space, which is kind of nice because it allows us to tease this apart. So for every 50 friends or family you had, you tended to get one contributor, but it was a separate pathway to donations. On average, donors contributed about $55. And on average, we raised roughly around 1,600. The really interesting thing that we also found is that once you reached your project goal, you actually were more likely to get contributors. So I talked about how 110 project views and 110 people just looking at your project led to one contributor. Well, after you hit 100%, each one of those views became more likely to turn into a contribution. So success bred success. For every 20 project views after you hit your goal, you were actually would get a donation. So here's kind of the general flow. And the thing that's really important to note here is it all comes back to your personal network to some degree, yes, but engagement. If you are going out and doing the groundwork to engage the world around you, that will ultimately lead into a successful project. And the quicker you achieve success, the more likely you are to bring in additional money to your research program. You need to build a scientific fan base. You need to build that engaged community that is interested in your work. If you have an engaged community, you're going to be able to raise money. It's not necessarily possible to be an overnight success and raise hundreds of thousands of dollars. I know actually in the news this week there's been a story of an artist who raised $300,000 in 2 days. And it's this sort of like, oh, wow, look at Kickstarter. We'll all be able to go out and raise hundreds of thousands of dollars. The reason that artist was able to do so was because she had an enormous fan base that was already engaged. So you need to have that engagement already in place to be able to raise those larger sums of money. So that's it. That's what the data says. And I'll just leave you with a couple of things. Like Jai said, round two actually is ongoing now. We have 75 scientists, so we've grown by half. And they're really tearing it up this time around. So you can find our projects at scifund.rockethub.com. We are one of those partner organizations, those curated partner organizations that we talked about earlier. And we maintain our blog where we have people posting about their projects and Jai and I kind of rambling on about crowdfunding at scifundchallenge.org, or you can find our hashtag. So that's it. Thank you.
I understand that Kickstarter, as opposed to Rocket Hub, has tighter rules in terms of what is a creative, quote-unquote, project. And I wanted to ask about that because of the sort of gray zone between educational research projects and creative projects that produce some kind of, for example, artistic product or object.
Our experience has been that's true, is that Rocket Hub does have a wider range of things they'll do. For example, I don't think Kickstarter really does science unless there's a strong creative element and they're doing a book along with it. You know, I don't think they do pure science. So Rocket Hub definitely does a wider range of stuff.
Nothing to add other than, I mean, they, as Kum Kum said, they do pre-approve every project, you know, at Kickstarter. So you could run it by them, certainly, and I'm sure you would get some kind of comment. But it's definitely set up for what they consider creatives. But that also expands to a lot of sort of little startup companies, digital projects, games, things that we don't tend to think of as the arts, are actually probably the largest funded things on Kickstarter, if you look at the statistics.
So how do you work that accountability thing? Do you have to be go through a nonprofit or an institution like to prove that you're going to use the money as you say you will? And then also, let's say the project turns out to be a bigger budget than you anticipate, and people have given you this money, and then you realize you need a lot more money to fulfill the money that they give.
So I can answer some of that. Is that for a Sci Fund anyway, just because of university rules of money coming in, we strongly suggest that all money gets routed through their local university. And I think pretty much everyone except one of the people involved with Sci Fund this time are at a university, maybe two. So that's the first thing, is that the check actually goes to, in the case of UC, it goes to the regents of the California. So that's one element. And in terms of accountability, I think the key part of how you, I think a key part is ongoing engagement with your audience about what you're doing. You know, when things come up, that's fine. But I think just, hey, here's my latest 2-week update. What's going on with my research? You know, and I think it's just part of that. You know, it's like, hey, you know, things took longer. We need more cash. It's going slower. This thing broke. I think that it's all about communication.
I think that's right. But I also do think that it's hard to tap people. I would feel it's hard to tap people for more money because of what I'd said. It wasn't an initial phase that I was raising money for. It was in the later stages. And so the accountability I wanted to do through the university, but that was my decision. I don't know what Kickstarter does about that. I got the check from Amazon. You know, it went into my bank account and it went straight out to the university. accountability. There was one other point, but we can come back to that.
Oh, also, have you heard of Sci Flies? That's another organization. Yeah.
I could answer some of that, too. I mean, each of the platforms really encourages people to have these very distinct sort of beginning and ending points to the project that you're asking for funding for, or if it's a part of a project, to clearly articulate it's finishing funds or it's my original research trip or whatever it is. And that they really, I think part of that vetting that Kickstarter does is to make sure that what you're sort of planning for is actually also doable. I know that people look at that, you know, but it is up to you to responsibly fulfill that. And I've backed, for instance, one project at a very small amount because I liked the idea that was a little iffier like that. And a year and a half later, I am still getting update emails from these people going, we're still raising money to do it. We're going to do it. And it's very frustrating. And I think that the platforms work really hard to weed out people who aren't really clear about what they're going to spend the money on or how much they're going to need, because you lose the trust of the public who's giving the money to do that kind of thing when you get too many of those. So I know that behind the scenes there's some work, you know, to make sure that people are and there's a lot of training too that's available to you through, you know, exactly what you've been doing. But Kickstarter has, if you look at their page, just millions and millions of questions like that that are answered by their experts. They have a blog that they maintain, and so they try very hard to sort of coach people so that that kind of thing doesn't happen.
If you're an unaffiliated artist, like not a faculty member at a university, are there options on any of these platforms? Or?
Any of them.
Yeah, the check would just come straight to you.
Yeah, one thing that we ran into with SciFund when we were trying to figure out how these funds would get to researchers, initially we talked about funds just going initially to individuals. The sort of problem with that can be that then there become tax implications for you, which have to be budgeted into your proposal when you post it, because there will be tax implications for money coming to you directly. So one of the reasons that we've encouraged our researchers to go through their universities is that that absolves them of those implications.
So if you're an outsider, and how do they know that you'll use the money as you say you will as an independent?
Well, I mean, that's up to you. One thing which I don't think has been hit on nearly enough, because crowdfunding is fairly new, is I think if you're anyone going out and doing a crowdfunding project and you don't end up delivering, you just abscond with the money, you're not going to be able to come back to that well and use it again. Right. That you really are trading in no small part on your credibility as an artist or as a researcher. Right. And if you violate that and if you break that and show yourself not to be a credible individual, then crowdfunding is going to be closed to you. Right.
One quick last question. How do you network and develop your fan base?
Well, for us, we were really looking at people promoting science education, science literacy through online science blogs. There's a really large and growing community, and one way that scientists have been trying to do the broadest outreach possible is by basically taking not only their work, but work within their field or work within their discipline and trying to post what's interesting and create an online persona where they really present the latest and most interesting research to the general public or even to other scientists. So that's one way that scientists, anyway, have been doing outreach. There's also a number of other ways that at least scientists have in terms of going out, giving lectures, getting into school systems. There are a lot of different tools, but that's I just know it from the science end.
And I just to say that, you know, building the fan base, you have to, for Kickstarter, when I say have to, it is very much based on my experience, and that was, I raised the money a year ago. I finished my campaign a year ago, maybe 15 months ago. So it was when it was much newer than it is now. You have to start with the people you know, and then you keep asking them to send to their lists, because those are the people who are interested. Now, I know that Crazy Wisdom, which is a film about a Tibetan Buddhist teacher, Johanna got hooked into some lists, e-lists, for people who are Buddhists and interested in this teacher. And that's through your initial sending out.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm actually a current SciFund participant. Very nice to meet you in person.
Hey.
It's a great experience, and I can testify how hard it was to make the video. But it's great. Just a quick question, actually going along what you said about accountability and credibility. Like, is there going to be like a collective effort to update the public on like what we do, what we have been doing with the funding we got? For example, like last year's SciFunders, like, for this year or next year, are you going to do a video to show like what they've been doing, what they have accomplished with that fund, to increase, you know, publicity and also to, you know, earn like public trust?
That's a great idea. I mean, yeah. You know,
yes, we will.
No, I mean, this sort of thing has come up a bunch of saying like, how do you act? Do we, as the organizers of SciFund, do we have some responsibility of keeping track of people and saying, do they go to Barbados with this money? And I think the answer is largely no, because the money is routed through the university. So, but I think that makes a lot of sense, is that, you know, after round one, hey, where are you now, 6 months later, a year later? You know, I think that's great.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I know I've been enjoying the updates I've been getting from the couple of projects I donated to last round. In fact, I'm really excited now that we're hitting the summer field season, since many of the round one was ecologists mm-hmm. with a defined field season. This summer should be really interesting to see what information comes out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, really curious about all the duck reproduction stuff. those updates have been kind of slowly trickling out, but they've been ramping up, particularly for the ecological research as people enter their field season. So that's been really exciting.
Cool. Yeah, because if you think about it, because the last round ended December 15th, and the money was dispersed by the end of the year. So it's not. I don't think there's been quite enough time yet for research mm-hmm. to just say, we've done this. So, but I think soon, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And I think one of the things which will apply for everyone is to give snippets of your project as you update. So, you know, because we had to go and do this other shoot, which actually led to a much more interesting film, I put up little, you know, 30-second videos or a picture of the camera woman or, you know, me falling in the mud or whatever it is. Because people are engaged and do want to know how it's proceeding. Because now, you know, certainly for me, people were with me. They didn't know. Most of the people I know had no idea how much work it is in making a film. And those snippets help them. Oh, now I see. So, you know, it's something for people. It's that fan base that you're talking about. It's both things. Kickstarter is unashamedly to raise money. But actually, and I was told that in the workshop, it's critical in my case, because then people are interested in the film. When they see the film at a local film festival or at a university or something, they think, oh, Yes, she sent me an email about it. I'll go and watch it. So,
so let me tie into that, actually, is that I think one of these campaigns can be a great way to actually grow your base and to have people to actually care about your work. I mean, what's, at least in the sciences, what is the traditional criticism, which is that, oh, you're right, you're spending your life working on something that only 10 people care about, you know? And boy, you know, stuff like this puts the death to that sort of criticism. You know, you have people who, if someone gives money to your project, they definitely care.
Mm-hmm. Okay, are there any more questions here? Go ahead.
Sorry, just one more. I guess it applies more to the like science-specific like projects. So I've been contacting like bloggers on like just ask them to post my project on their website. Then I've been getting like questions, like some questions like, I'm asking money to start my research. I'm collaborating with a nonprofit organization to develop a product, and at the same time I'm working at a university lab. So the first question I got is like, why didn't the nonprofit or why didn't your university fund your project? And then there are questions like, even though you're advertising your product as very sustainable, like very like affordable, like $8 versus like $100, how can you be sure that is the people that I'm delivering the product to, like in Africa, they are going to buy your product? So it's very wonderful, like opens up a whole new discussion. I've been like writing emails every day to like to answer them. But then at the same time, I was like, is there, like, I didn't want to put too much information on my own site to when I start the project, but is there any way to, I guess I can put on my own blog to answer those questions, to answer people. But then I'm just wondering if there's any way to tell people ahead of time, in general, like, why do scientists need money, since there's NSF Foundation, there's EPA, there's all those other, like, institutions. Like, why would we need, like, $2,000?
Well, you know, I think that's an excellent point. And particularly with, we actually ran into this when we tried to post stuff last time on Slashdot. And there is a sense there that what science is the Hubble telescope and a linear accelerator, stuff that is billions of dollars. And so $2,000, that's not even pay for your bottled water. You know, how is this even useful? You know? And so I think it is sort of a retraining. It's like, wait a minute, you know, science funding is getting harder. And, you know, often, and you know, $5,000, $3,000, that's actually enough money to make a real difference. It's, I mean, not all science is sending a man to Mars. In fact, very little science is sending a man to Mars. Maybe no science.
One thing I think we've also been really impressed by is that crowdfunding, at least for science, can often fill a very different niche. In round one, and actually in round two as well, we found a lot of graduate students that maybe aren't at the level where they're applying for large grants, or maybe while they're partnering with an organization, this isn't necessarily the organization's first priority. So this is a real way for graduate students, professors, et cetera, to fund that, you know, that small bit of research that would otherwise fall between the cracks. Sometimes it might be the most interesting, riskiest research that they're about to do that wouldn't otherwise be able to receive funding from traditional sources. So this provides a way of saying, well, look, here's my $2,000. I need to do this crazy harebrained experiment and see if it comes out. And then, and this is where I'm really excited to see kind of the power of crowdfunding for science get leveraged. It's, then you can say, okay, not only have I done my small, risky experiment and got some crazy preliminary data, but I've done it while doing outreach. Then you go to NSF, then you go to your funding body and say, here's my preliminary data, and I did it with crowdfunding. So not only am I doing really hot science, I'm doing really hot science, and I'm engaging people in it already. So I'm going to come to you with a scientific package ready to go for the big bucks, and I'm going to bring an engaged audience so that my broader impacts are huge and much bigger than they would have been had I just started from a government grant from the first place. So it's this incubator, really, for kind of high-profile and interesting science in the future.
Yeah, I totally agree. Get this information like on the side, mm-hmm. so people, even before they actually read our like projects, like mm-hmm. see the video, they actually have a kind of ideas like, oh, okay, that's why they need money, that's why like mm-hmm. they don't get enough research funding.
I think that's a great idea, but I think as you've already discovered, there's some element to this to answering the same question over and over and over again. You know, I think that's because a lot of people won't, even if you post all this, like for example, on our site, there's so much stuff there. In fact, too much stuff there. But is it reasonable that people have read all 100 of our blog posts? There's over 100 blog posts. Of course not. So we are answering the same question again and again. And so we have it again and again and again. And so we have an FAQ page where we try to put things out there. But I don't know how you get around just sort of having to cut and paste a lot.
Yeah, it's kind of inevitable, but in some ways there's a benefit to that, in which case someone's asking you that question, and if you're giving them a good answer, you're engaging them already. So it's rather than them getting it from a static web page, you're engaging in a conversation. This isn't to say that you should just make everything mysterious, so you have to have these conversations, but it's another form of engagement. If someone's interested enough to ask you, oh, hey, why are you doing this? That means they're interested enough to maybe take a second look at your project.
And I do want to... Thank you. I want to add that I raised $16,000 through Kickstarter, but I think my other grants came through after that because Kickstarter was a good way for me to do a shoot. Because sometimes people think if you're doing a shoot, you're going on a jolly, and you know you're not. For all of you who know, you work 18-hour days, and the crew I work with take almost no money for their fees, and so on and so forth. So, and you're not staying in 5-star hotels. because I could do the second shoot, I raised another $25,000, give or take. After Kickstarter, because I could see that there were people interested and I would have an audience for the film. So it is, incubator is the right word. It's a place to start. But somehow you have to be closer to the end of your project, I think, for people to feel that they're going to make a difference. Yeah. You know, one more thing I'd like to say is, in terms of the amounts, please do get in touch if you're thinking of doing a Kickstarter or similar, is if you look at the demographics of who your family and friends are, you pitch it at that. Like most of mine were not actually $5 and $10 things. They were $100, $150. And so I should again have perhaps had a $200 option instead of going from $100 to $250. Anyway, whatever it is, think of the demographics of your initial outreach and set your funding like that. If it's students, I mean, really $5 is a lot for, as we all know, for a student. So I also did not ask anyone from the campus. I felt I didn't want it to bleed into my relationships with people. But I bumped into one woman and I had just raised my money. I just reached the goal, but the campaign hadn't finished. And it was in the Coral Tree, and someone I hadn't seen in 2 or 3 years. And I said, oh, my God, I'm so excited. I got $10,000, right? And she said, well, why haven't I heard about this? And the next thing, she gave a $250 donation just like that. So, but I didn't want to do it through work people. Too complicated to ask people at work for money.
I think one last comment I'd like to make, too, is just about the language that you use in it. And, you know, when you were talking about, can I pre-prepare some of these answers? I mean, one of the biggest pieces of advice I've seen people give is, yes, do that before you even begin. Think about what you're going to send to press, to blogs. What's your email going to look like? What are your Twitters going to look like? Pre-prepare all of those things so you aren't continually answering those things during the course of the 30 days when you're madly trying to raise money and do all the other parts of the project. And also, the biggest mistake I've seen academics make is take their academic research description of what they do and put it up on a platform like this. And those are the people that fund it, like 1% of what their goal. It's really, really horrible. It's not academic. It's best to leave academics out of it. Don't say you're a student. One example right now, UCSB has the Real Loud Film Festival. Last year, somehow, and I haven't examined the campaigns, but last year they raised a lot of money. It was an undergraduate student organization to do this film festival, and La Vista. This year, the way they pitched it was, we're an undergraduate student film festival that blah, 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 blah. And they're at like 20% of their goal. And I feel that there was something wrong in the language there. You really need to appeal to people on the merits of what you do, not kind of where you come from or what it's doing for your research trajectory or what it means in your field, but really speak to people in a different way that's going to hit them. It's non-academic.
You know, one thing that I don't know.
Look at a Kickstarter page.
Yeah.
I don't think one thing we've quite hit hard enough is that we've talked a lot about the materials, is that having a good video and making sure your materials are jargon-free and compelling, and all that is very important. But I think the majority of the effort, this is the opposite. We've used this analogy. This is the opposite of the field of dreams. You know, if you build it, they're not going to come. You know, or they're not going to come just because you build it. You know, I mean, most of the effort is your project has to be in the range of good enough. But once it's in the range of good enough, if it's not good enough, if it's too jargony, it doesn't help. But if it's in the range of good enough, the most of the effort's going to be getting the word out that you've got this thing going on and you want you to know about it. Just because once you've created your great video, man, your work is just started.
Yeah, two of my favorite projects actually in round one of SciFund. I mean, absolute favorite, dynamite video, dynamite proposal. Not funded, not even like less than 10%. And that's when we went back and looked at the data, they had done very little outreach and very little work. They basically assumed if we posted it, this great, I mean, beautiful, amazing piece of work, that something would happen, and nothing.
Okay, any more questions here? Meredith, do you want to come up and ask some questions that we've been getting? Or, yeah, and you can be on film too. This is Meredith Murr, our Director of Research Development over in the Office of Research.
Okay, so we had a few questions. Most of them fall into two themes. One relates to intellectual property. Have there been researchers who have been hesitant to post their projects on any crowdfunding because of concerns about intellectual property? And then how are universities dealing with not only intellectual property but also compliance issues like human subjects or anything along those lines?
So I can answer at least from part of it is that we haven't run into those issues because I think because most of the people we've been dealing with are ecologists and other kinds of scientists, not engineers, those who are going to be putting out products. And so the whole question of what happens if you're putting out products, I don't know. I personally have no idea.
Well, and preliminary data, things that hasn't been published yet, if you put your experimental design, I mean, someone could poach that just as easily.
Well, that could be, but I think, I personally feel that crowdfunding works really in parallel with something called open science, which is that you push your stuff out as you're doing it. And honestly speaking, for most science, I think most scientists are paranoid that people are going to steal their work. Most people, it is not. If you're studying these birds in Panama, nobody else can even get there, for God's sake. I think.
Unless they do a Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah. So I think for most of the time, at least the kind of scientists you're dealing with, the idea that someone might steal your research, it's not going to happen. Of course, the situation is all different if you're working in sort of Drosophila research and some sort of very, very highly contested stuff. So, and the second piece about stealing your research, about what I would say is that often the stuff that a general audience, there's sort of two audiences. There's the audience of your peers, and then there's the audience, the general audience. And in terms of this, if you're just reaching out to a more broad audience, they don't actually are going to care so much about your last week of experimental results. They do, however, might care about, like, what does all of this mean? What are the latest developments in your field? So from the perspective of reaching out to your audience, I don't know if necessarily pushing out the latest week of last week of data is going to be the thing that's going to be the most compelling. And there was a second question there.
About the human subjects and the compliance issues.
All I know is that we ran all these. I don't know if we ran into that question.
Mm-mm. Nope.
I don't think there were many human subjects projects we had. Mm-mm.
And that's different for me because my
films are part of my university research. So that's why I wanted the university involved and had to work out where the boundaries were for a Kickstarter project. Intellectual property, I wanted my film far enough advanced, but I also wanted it public so that, because if people have a fair amount of money, they could make a film much, much better than mine and much faster. So I wanted mine out in public as well so that I had a film that was in the works. And after that, you're not worried, It's open, let people take the ideas. If they can sleep at night doing that, that's fine. You just carry on. So it's a little bit, you don't worry. Compliance, yes, I do human subjects. I'm a methodologist. So I teach critical ethnography, so I absolutely do all of that. Again, because I'm running the money through the university, there's a requirement. But my initial grants were from Academic Senate, ISBA, thank you very much. IHC, thank you. So my initial grants were from the university so that I could just get the project off the ground.
And there's another piece. There's another piece to that, which is that if you're putting your stuff out there, and you essentially are planting a flag by putting your stuff out there. There's one argument for in open science is that you're less likely to get scooped because people in the community know, hey, he did that like 6 months ago, you know, because I read his blog about it.
So the flip side of that issue, was another one that was sent in about how you think the scientific publications, Science, Nature, wherever, do you think that they're going to have a different perspective on research because it was funded by crowdfunding versus traditional funding sources?
No. When it comes to actually publishing your work, it goes through the peer review process, and good science is good science. The funding source should be irrelevant. So ideally, no, it shouldn't matter. It should. It's the results. It's the science. It's the product.
A lot of the artists that I was talking to, too, how did they feel about, you know, with this different kind of funding? Do you get this sort of watered-down common denominator version of what art and culture is, for instance? And their answer was very much no, that people actually are better judges of good work than you would expect them to be, that these kind of things rise to the top, that you do have your circles of people already who recognize your work and are going to fund it, and they have found it's a non-issue.
So, in science, the issue of whether this funding source might affect your ability to get published, the question that often comes up with pharma, you know, if you're getting money from a pharma organization, is that going to skew your results? Now, the question is, does taking crowdfunding money skew your results in some way? And I can't imagine how that would be. So I think it's a non-answer, because in the end, crowdfunding money is, in the end, you get a single check from Rocket Hub or Kickstarter or Indiegogo or wherever. It's functionally no different than if you're sitting next to a rich dude on the plane on a flight somewhere and you get them excited about what you're doing and say, hey, I'll write you a check for $15,000.
You know, never happens, however many conversations you have.
But, you know,
urban legend.
But that's what it is, you know, so you get a single check. So it works with university systems. It's really... It's a non-factor.
I think the devil's advocate way to look at that is, oh, well, they couldn't convince the National Science Foundation to fund it, so therefore they had to go this non-traditional route. And hopefully, I mean, again, all peer reviewers are humans too, so they might have these inherent biases. But it will be interesting to see as this experiment goes on whether or not you can, you know, make any conclusions.
Well, I want to say one more thing just very quickly about this is that perhaps something like this SciFund would push the NSF to becoming broader. I think that's something to think about, that as good science is done through this model, then they've got to open. They do respond, so it's like a push to make them open up.
That's certainly happened commercially. If you look at, like, I think it was the TikTok watch, that you talked about. There's another iPod Docker that was a big one on Kickstarter recently. And I think it was the iPod Docker. They were saying precisely we had taken this to Apple. They didn't see that it was a fundable notion, basically. They didn't want to put the money into it. And so now we go back to them and we say, look, we raised $1 million in 2 days. And it does change the dialogue and the relationship between whomever that funder is, whether it's commercial or, you know, not commercial, and the product or research.
And then the other big set of questions that we got was all about the financial mechanism. And so I don't know if you guys want to talk about how you actually go through the university, how that process works, you know, what, you know, how do you get it set up? Do you have to go through the development office? You know, exactly how does that work?
So we dealt with that a lot. And so to talk about it from the perspective of UCSB, this is considered a gift. And meaning that there's no reporting requirements, there's no strings attached, you just get a check. So in terms of overhead, usually for science, if you think of an NSF grant with significant reporting requirements, usually I don't know what the overhead is UCSB. It's over, there we go, over half. 51.5% goes to the university as overhead. For gifts at UCSB, it's 2.5%. And functionally what the money ends up as. So the simplest answer is talk to your local grants administrator. Say, hey, I've got this thing coming in. And it functionally just comes in as an account. And you'll tap that account just as you would tap an account you get from any other source.
Yeah, the answer really varies by university. And we had participants have a number of different experiences, both good and some bad. But the sort of short answer is it will vary depending on the university or foundation you're working with. And as soon as you think you're going to start doing this, get in contact with them. There is no standard protocol yet because this is fairly new, and hopefully that will get worked out in short order as universities realize that this is another source of funding for them. Talk to your department's grants administrator or talk to the foundation that you're working with and find the sort of most efficient route that you can get that money into your work.
And if you look, if you just look at this, we have answered it. If you go to the blog at scifundchallenge.org, we've answered a ton of these questions of how to make this work with the university because we've talked to a bunch of administrators. So
I think the way that I did it, for example, through Kickstarter, is I told the university in advance needed to find out exactly what the rules were. It is treated as a gift, so I keep getting invited to these chancellor's breakfasts and so on. And I finally rang them and said, look, you know, I really don't feel it's a gift because I gave it for my research and so on and so forth. So the key is, I think, in terms of getting the money and getting the check, is it's counted as a gift. The overhead, of course, well, we're raising such small amounts that the overhead is almost nothing. And then running it through your department or ISBA, whoever you're running it through, it's important that they know that this is coming in because otherwise no one knows what to do with it. I mean, you know, development got the check and then something got... one of my grants, I don't know if they found the check yet. You know, so there's all sorts of funny things that happen. But definitely talk to the departmental administrator and then talk to your research office because the UC certainly has that rule. You cannot ask for money and put the UC's name on it because there's issues of liability. So please do. You can't say you're a university person, I think, almost.
I'd like to say a little something more about budgets. Just thinking about, you know, that you're losing 2% here, you're losing 3 to 5% to Amazon. You yes. give between 4% and, you know, 8 or 9% to whomever's hosting it. To think really carefully about budgeting that into your overall plan, because many of the artists that I talked to hadn't done that. They sort of went, oh, I need $4,500. It's a small amount. And, you know, 10, 12, 20% when that gets taken away is a lot. And a number of other people made mistakes about the rewards that they were giving out, that they ended up being very costly when you have this small, small budget for what you're doing. And so one person I talked to, actually, his campaign was unsuccessful the first time on Kickstarter, still didn't learn the lesson, went back and did it again, had a successful campaign, and then ended up getting about half the money he expected because he was doing sort of personalized DVDs, you know, T-shirts, things that were very labor-intensive to send out to keep track of people's donations, very expensive to make. So a good example that another artist did is look at his flat files of his prints that he had stacking up from years and years and said, you know, for $25, you get something to be determined from my flat files. And people loved it. It's a surprise gift in the mail. It's something great that you get. Higher amounts were phone calls from his mom and dad, a former Buddhist nun and a crafts teacher in Oakland, I think it was, you know, and funny things like this that you know, like you said, didn't add a lot of cost to the project, but really sort of got people in there. But think about that in your budget, because in a really small project, if you're losing 20% of that and you're not realizing you're going to, it could kill your project. So
absolutely, and if you look on our page, you know, it says please add postage for so much and so much and so much for everything, and then at the $5,000 level it says don't worry about the postage. Yeah.
I actually asked our director of sponsored projects to come in to just give some backup answers for these financial questions in case there were any technicalities that we're not covering from our lay perspectives. So would you mind just coming up here, and then you get to be on video too. So this is Virginia Anders from the Office of Research.
Thank you, Virginia. I really think you covered it well. And when Barbara first came to me a couple months ago about this, we sat there thinking, what do we do about this? And tried to think of a lot of different issues. The only thing that concerns me a little bit about this could be the possible individual tax consequences. Like you said that you received the check from Kickstarter. Yes. You don't want to do that, or you have personal tax consequences. If this, somehow they can make a check out to the regions of the University of California or your respective institution, it's better for you as a person because you don't have that income liability, which is another thing you'd have to budget in to cover. But other than that, you know, all the compliance things, if it's run through the university, they're just the same as if you got a, you know, a gift from any person or any other foundation or something that didn't have strings attached to it. All those things still apply. So I think you've pretty much covered it. But do you have any questions for me at all about any of this? It sounds like you've got it all figured out. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Virginia. Sure. That was helpful. Okay, so it looks like we are finished with our questions from both the web audience and our local Santa Barbarans. So I'm going to conclude the performance, and let's give one last big thank you to our presenters today.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.